right. It's October 5th, 2010. We're in Smith Hall at KU, and we are having an interview with Father Monsignor Vince Crisha, who lives in Lawrence, and did live in Lawrence for many years previously. And I guess, well, let me say at the outset, one thing, we're trying to make a public record of this. We want to put these things up on a Religion in Kansas website, so we want to be sure you understand that this is public. Don't say anything that would be deep, dark secret. Not that I would expect that. So I guess we'd like to start with a little bit of your story, maybe what your childhood was like. How did you become a priest? How did you undertake that matter of very serious dedication?
I think of this often. Considered, my wife to have been a blessing. Both of my parents were Catholic. Both of my extended families were Catholic. So I had always the support of not only my immediate family, but all my extended family. And so we grew up in the church. The family was first, the church was second. Whenever the family would get together, it was always some discussion going on about church. I had an uncle who was also a priest, and I have an older brother who is also a priest. And sometimes I wonder if, they seem to be held up on a pedestal all the time. And I thought, that would not be so bad. Maybe I could get up on that pedestal too. So I was influenced by them a lot, I think. I'm one of seven children. I'm the middle one. There are two boys, a girl, me, a girl, two boys. So I'm the kind of the peak child. And I went through Catholic schools, all my elementary school and my high school. And then thought maybe I might be called to the priesthood, but wasn't sure. So I entered the seminary. And you always enter the seminary not with the idea that you're going to be a priest, but the idea that you're going to be a seminarian and see where it leads. Well, it just kept leading me. When I was in school, at the end of every semester, they would post a list on the board, on the bulletin board, and say, the following men are requested not to come back next semester. So everybody runs on the bulletin board and sees, there's my name on there. And I never appeared, so I figured, well, I guess here I am. I've been ordained since 1964, which I think is 46 years now. And it has been a most wonderful life for me. I can't imagine any other way of life that would have provided me with the opportunities, with the freedom, with the people, with the friends. One of the things that I really, really find impressive is the networking that you can do in the church. I can say who I am, and then I meet somebody else, and pretty soon we're connected with somebody else. There are always connections, and that's a really nice experience. My most of my priestly life has been spent in the university. I was 8 years at Washburn University, and 28 years at KU at the St. Lawrence Center. I love KU, and I had wonderful bishops who were my supervisors. The greatest bishop was Archbishop Strecker, but he was a kind of a leader who I knew that, because we had a lot of work to do to build the St. Lawrence Center, and I knew that he would let me stretch myself clear out to the end of the branch and maybe almost fall, but he would never let me fall. I had that confidence that he was always behind me. He was always supportive, always willing to be of assistance. I could call him. Like if I get depressed and say, I don't know if this is going to work or not, I can call him at 9 o'clock in the morning and say, come in, be here by 11. He was that kind of an open supervisor who himself challenged me to do this and then supported me all the way through it. His image for us was that we would become a true Newman Center. I don't know if you were very familiar with that, but most college campuses, they have a Newman Center. And those are not true Newman Centers. They're more like clubs. It's a club you can belong to or a place you can go where they have a lounge and a TV and whatever that is. But he wanted us to develop the true idea of a university, which was given to us by John Henry Cardinal Newman. And if you remember my latest visit, it was 2 weeks ago to England, when Cardinal Newman was beatified, so he's called Blessed Cardinal Newman. But he wrote an interesting book at the end of the 19th century entitled The Idea of a University. And he was always promoting the idea of a liberal arts education. That people should be educated in the liberal arts first and then advanced into graduate school, perhaps, into a profession that they would choose. He saw also at that time that higher education in England was becoming very specialized, and it was built upon what was utilitarian. And that was the beginning of the specialization utilitarian approach, and that's what we have today. He believed that a university that did not teach theology was not a true university. He believed that theology was a true science, and we had to have that. And, you know, I just say this, you know, just from my experience, but we became a teaching institution. We became a school of, well, we were not technically a school of theology, but we had five people with master's degrees on our staff who were teaching, and we had very interested students. And one of the things that students used to say to me a lot was, you know, this class in theology makes the rest of my education make sense. You know, somehow there's a unifying principle, there's something that brings everything together, which makes everything else make sense to me. And a lot of students say this. So I was here for 28 years, and I got transferred to a parish. I'd never been in a parish my whole life. I didn't know what to do. I went there, and I thought that these people would be like students. They weren't. And they thought I'd be like a pastor, and I wasn't. So finally, I was chaplain of the KU football team for 15 years, and we had a couple good years in there. So, so I was interested in the grade school football program, and had a lot of fun with that. But I had a real challenge trying to get people to be interested in developing an understanding of their faith. And that was really where eventually I figured I'm not making much progress. I think probably they would do better if they had a younger priest here. So I chose to retire and come back to where I wanted to be all the time. Never wanted to leave. Come back to Lourdes.
Where was the parish?
In Topeka? I was in the parish at St. Anne's, a prayer village.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Off of Kansas?
Yeah.
The little bar.
Yeah.
And are you from Kansas originally?
Yeah, I'm from Topeka.
From Topeka.
That's where my family.
So that's where your extended family was based.
I still have three brothers there, and so a few aunts and uncles, but mostly they're all departed.
So you went to seminary in the Archdiocese?
In Denver.
In Denver.
At that time, all of us were being sent to Denver. Today, most of the people are being sent to St. Louis or Chicago, but we chose Denver.
Okay, is there a seminary here?
No.
Okay.
You have to be a pretty big diocese to be able to run a seminary, to have a faculty, to have all the requirements for a seminary.
Okay, they used to have a high school seminary.
We did.
But I believe that's not functioning anymore.
No, it hasn't functioned for a long time. Yeah.
Well, I wonder if you could say something about, and in a way compare when you came and then when you left St. Lawrence. What was life like in the Catholic community on campus when you got here? And for openers, was it in the same location?
It was in the same location. There were five houses around there that we had to that we were able to purchase, and then we were able to three of those we moved off the land, and then the other two were not they were not engineeringly sound to move them, so we had to tear those down. But I had this 8 years experience at Washburn, so I had a little bit. But when I arrived, our budget was $32,000, and it was given to us all from the Archdiocese. We had one full-time person and a part-time secretary, and we had a building, which was a house. And I was really scared. I didn't want to come to KU. Oh, man, Bishop is making a mistake. I mean, he's got the wrong person. And so when I heard it, I think back, I think it was set up. But I arrived on a Saturday, and I moved into the house, and I was there on Saturday evening, and the doorbell rings, and I go to the doorbell, here's this young woman, and she said, school was just starting, so people were just coming, and she said, I was wondering if you could tell me anything about the Monophysite heresy. I thought, oh my gosh, I haven't talked about that for you. I think somebody set her up to see just how smart I was, you know, how capable I was to handle the job. But the place was in pretty much disrepair, and I went to the Archbishop and I said, you know, our place looks awful. I mean, just the front door and like, dogs had pawed it, and it just didn't look very good. And the basement was flooded out. A lot of people at the end of the last semester had left some of their stuff in the basement. It was all water. So he said, well, why don't we just do something cosmetic and just make it look better than it is and smell better. And so he said, I'll give you $15,000. Now, this was in 1977. So $15,000, and then we just painted and put some wallpaper up. But one day, and this is why, like, I believe in God so much, because things happen unexpected, you know, they just happen. So one day we're out there painting the outside of the building, and this big white Lincoln goes down Crescent Road, and pretty soon the brakes go on, and the car backs up, and there, at that time there's a driveway on Crescent Road, and then drives in the driveway. Oh my gosh, are we in trouble or something? And this tall gentleman, very distinguished, gets out of this big white Continental, and he says, hello, I'm John O'Leary. And I said, oh, nice to meet you. And I introduced myself. So what goes on here? And I said, well, you know, I don't know. I just got here, and I really don't know myself. What do you think should go on? Well, we had a bit of a conversation, and then when we finished the conversation, he pulled out his checkbook, and he wrote me a check for $100. Nobody had ever done that for me in my life. He wrote me a check for $100. So he handed it to me, and then he reached into his suit pocket, and he pulled out his card, and he said, if you ever need any help, give me a call. He gave me his card. Wow. So he was the president of the KU Alumni Association, and he graduated from KU in 1948. And he lived out of Western Kansas, so he always said that he was the unusual guy. He was a Jayhawker in Wildcat territory. He was a Democrat, he was a Republican in Democrat territory. No, a Democrat in Republican territory, and he was a Catholic in Protestant territory. So he said, man, I know how to deal with people, you know? I know how to get along, you know. So I waited for about 2 weeks, and I called him, and I said, do you think maybe you could help me? We could find alumni and people, and we could get some, we could raise some money. He said, yeah, I'm going to be in town again, and I'll stop when he set a date. He came in. That was the beginning of what happened. So we found a lot of other people who were KU alum and were willing to help, and we started out on a campaign, and this is where we are today. But the building and all that was really designed mostly just for the program, and the program is the most important. What happens to people, you know? So,
so are there a lot of people involved?
There were a lot of people. Well, when I started, the budget was 32,000. When I left, it was 1.3 million. And I was really surprised one day. Chancellor called me, Chancellor Hemingway, and that had never happened. He called, and we were talking, and he said, what's your annual budget there? And I said, it's 1.3 million. And he said, do you know that you give a $1.3 million gift to the university every year? Wow. He said, because the students that are involved in your program are having a good college experience, and that's what we want for all of our students. I thought it was really, really nice. I was sort of taken back by it, you know. But, and That, you know, the great thing here at KU was I really wanted to become a partner with the university, to work together, because we were all in the same endeavor, basically helping young people discover where they were going to go in life and helping them have a good college experience. So I was very welcomed by at that time it was the School of Religion, and we had a board, and I was invited to be on that board. And then I got to know Hope. Then Chancellor Buda came, and he was really helpful to me. He said, the most important thing you have to do is be visible on this campus. So, you know, you go to basketball, you go to football, you go to lectures, you go to different things, so that you get to know people. And that was a really fortunate thing for me as well. I got to know a lot of people. Even now, it's so nice being back, because you see people at restaurants or the grocery store or something. They say, oh, it's so great to have you back. And so it's like a family. Lawrence is like a family, and the university is also. I think Vice Chancellor Ambler, his goal was to really build more and more community within the university. And I kept thinking, how are you going to do it? This is so big. This place is so many people, and it's so big, and so differentiated. But he was right. And we were able to do that. So.
Can you say something about what day-to-day life was like in the center? What do students do when they go there?
Yeah, we did not want to... The familiar phrase at this time, nationally, in many centers, was that everybody was decrying the fact that, you know, we just have lounge lizards. You know, people who come and they want to turn on the TV and watch a soap opera, or they want to lounge around and have a cup of coffee or whatever. And we were pretty different. We wanted to be an education center. We wanted to have a holistic approach. And we wanted our students to come there for a reason. They were here for a purpose. Either they were going to take a class, they were going to volunteer in some efforts that we were putting forth. They were going to be involved in some service projects. But the most important thing that we wanted was that they take the classes. And then we found soon after, we estimated at that time there were 8,000 Catholic students on KU campus. And I don't know what they would estimate today. But and we had 300 students taking classes during the week. We had classes in the afternoon, usually after many of the hours were closed here. And we had classes in the evenings. And then we found out that, you know, along with... And this was also Newman's idea. Along with the teaching of the faith, we also had to have spiritual direction and spiritual guidance so that they could absorb and integrate the faith into their student life. And then we were able to put on others who were able to help us with that. So during the day, then I would do a lot of appointments. We did a lot of marriage preparation. Because I think it's really, really important, people getting married, and how they look at marriage, how they understand each other. So we had a huge marriage preparation program. It was a year-long program where they would start, and they would take theology of marriage, and they would take the ordinary finances and communication and all that. And then we would take a lot of the social implications of marriage. Why do we have it? Why do we have to build good marriages in order to have a good society, have a strong society with a structure that was supportive to people? So we had that and then other church-related things like baptisms. But we were a university community, which wasn't just a student community, but it was also university faculty and staff and administration people. So we had about 120 families, but our focus was not on the family life. Our focus was on the students, and those who became involved wanted to help us with the students. And I found out early on that the faculty are what we call the credit card to the university. They can open doors and get you to meet people and get you to know a lot of people. So we were open every day, from 8 in the morning until 11 o'clock at night, except on Saturdays, we closed at 5. And students would come there to study. We had a lot of study area. We had a library. We had a computer science, a computer center where they could come work on computers. And we engaged statewide support, and then it was even national support. We had support grants from different foundations, and then we have alumni. At one point, we had support from every state in the union, including Hawaii. So it was really interesting. We did a national telephone thing. We would call people, call our alumni. You guys, you know, when we first started that, so, oh man, we don't even have telephone numbers. Where do you start on this? And so I was talking to somebody at the Endowment Association. Said, oh, we can help you. We can help you get started on it. So they came. Well, then we had, in the attic, we found this box of, well, you guys probably wouldn't know what these are. They're called IBM punch cards. Have you ever heard of those? Yeah. Well, they were, and then, so we...
They're not possibly old enough to know that.
Yeah, I can't remember. So we had this one woman. She was so wonderful. And I credit her for laying the foundation for everything that happened. Because she agreed to take the cards that we had, come to the Alumni Association, and see if she could update these cards. And we got a pretty significant list. So we had national telephone, and this one student called this one man, and this man said, I don't know, how'd you get my name? He said, well, I don't know, I guess, did you come to St. Lawrence Center sometime when you were here? And he said, you know, I think I did come over there. I was dating a girlfriend who was a Catholic. He said, ah, that's probably how we got your name. And he said, well, listen, take me off your list. And this young man, he was very sharp. He said, well, what's it worth to you? The guy said, I'm going to send you $10, but take me off. Hey, thanks a lot. You paid for the telephone call. So we had a lot of stories like that at the beginning. We were really green, and we ventured out on things. But it all worked, you know? And I think that when you approach something with the sort of a positive attitude and an awareness of the base and goodness of people, it works. It happens.
What were some of the service projects that stand out in your mind?
We would have over 100 students each year go on a spring break alternative. And I always took each year a group of students to Mexico. And we had a great time, you know. We never know whether we did much work, but we sure, you know, we grew a lot because we began to just meet the people. And the idea in this kind of work is always to know the people. And then maybe you paint a house or do something like that. But it's meeting the people. We also did, we always did a March for Life in Washington every year. We took 5 buses of students to Washington for that. We did a lot locally with a food kitchen. Actually, I think you have probably heard of the Link Food Kitchen in Lawrence. You know, that was started by St. John's Parish, and we worked with them, and then it became ecumenical. We handled that. We did food kitchen. We did a lot with mothers, you know, young mothers, especially mothers who were single mothers, with food and clothes and stuff like that. So we did a lot of those kinds of projects, and it depended upon what was coming on at the time, you know. So. Because a lot of social issues raised, like different years, you have different issues that come up because of different occurrences.
Did you get into a lot of, I was going to say arguments, maybe healthy debates or something with students over church policies?
You know, we didn't. And I think probably students who were experiencing those kinds of things didn't come to our place. I think it seemed like there were students who were eager to learn why, or what, to learn why they believed what they believed, and why the church did this, or that, you know, whatever it was. We had... you know, women's ordination was a bit of an issue for a while, but then that's all faded out. You know,
I would think that'd still be a fairly big issue.
Yeah. Within the church, as far as I know, I don't encounter it. We had there's a whole lot of things that the birth control issue is a big issue for, and then we've really come a long way in understanding that and understanding another approach to that, which is very creative and very respectful of women, and it's called natural family planning, but it's built on a whole system of theology and biology, and then one of the concerns with that is what's really now showing up, in fact, is Western Europe is experiencing a lot of lower population. Austria is not even reproducing itself, and other. So we begin to see that what was happening back then has now shown some effects that are not good for the human race. So most of our students were more eager. They probably weren't even that informed of a lot of church issues. What they would get from the public press. And oftentimes it wasn't as reliable. Yes?
After you went to the church, I understand you just visited Britain for the... How was that experience? And then how did you find... Maybe getting far abreast from Kansas, but did you feel you were representing Kansas, I guess, is the hook. And just, what was that like, going to London?
Oh, it was wonderful. There was a priest from New Jersey who organized... I didn't know any of these priests who were going. I just met him at the airport. And there were five of us. And we had a layman from Tulsa, and we had another married couple who said they'd never travel with a bunch of priests again. One of the things I discovered with them, they wanted to eat, it's time to eat. We like to dine, it means you sit down, you have before dinner, and then you have an appetizer, and then you have a nice meal, and you have a bottle of wine, and you talk about the day. That's sort of our lifestyle. Because we're not married, we don't have families. It was very interesting how welcome the Pope was. There were some protests, I guess, but for the most part, people were welcoming him, even individuals that we would talk to, in terms that England needs somebody to speak, that they were... there was a gentleman at Westminster Abbey. I don't think he was ordained, but he was Anglican. And he said that England is on the epicenter of self-destruction, that it's it really, really has to... And they were hoping that the Pope would be able to bring a sense of unity. And he talked pretty square, I think, to the Parliament and also to the Queen Elizabeth. So I really enjoyed it. We spent 2 days in London. We spent a day in Littlemore and Oxford. And then we spent the other time, rest of the time in Birmingham. And then the actual beatification mass was in Birmingham. And that's where...
Is that where he was?
That's where the Pope was, yeah.
I mean, is that where Newman had been bishop?
Yeah, it's where he was really interesting how they talked about... He worked so hard because he wanted to show that the Anglican Church was truly in the tradition, and he was not able to come up with that in his... And he was a brilliant mind. So when he chose to lead the Anglican Church and become Catholic... But it was interesting, too. Do you want to hear about Newman?
Yeah.
That trip to England was more about Newman than it was about the Pope. But Newman, he went to Italy, and he did not like Italy, what he knew of it before. He thought it was dirty and all kinds of people, and it wasn't as sophisticated as England was. And the Roman Church was not nearly as high class and everybody. And so he went there, and then he discovered so many different things. Father Dominic Barbary, who was the one who actually brought him into the church, was a beggar. He would be out begging for people. And then he met Alphonsus Liguori, who was the same thing. And then he met the academic people, especially a priest by the name of Perrone, who really advised him and helped him a lot. But he seemed to be enlivened by that. he thought, these are really people who are not just academic, you know, just thinking, but they're engaged with other people, and they're trying to help in situations. His life seemed to change quite a bit. When, and this is only my own opinion, but doing a lot of reading on him, because that's what I was challenged to do when I was sent to KU, was to do Newman's work, and, or put his ideas in. And he just seemed to be a different person. He was always at odds with his fellow Anglican academics and theologians, and they were always disputing. And, but he found that he could have that, and then he found the other aspect of just ordinary people doing things, you know, kind of living their faith, I guess. That was what, that was my discovery.
Can you say a little more about the family planning classes that you had at St. Lawrence? And they must have had some reception, even though, as I'm sure you're well aware, a lot of Catholics really disagree with the church and birth control.
Yeah, and I think that, that a lot of it is a misunderstanding. And, but we had certified teachers who were teaching that to our engaged couples. And then, you know, as that program grew, we had a lot more. And students would say, you know, nobody ever told us this before. We never knew about this. They didn't even know the whole biology of it or the physiology of it. And now it's gone. It's advanced far from here. And it is. We have a big program in Kansas City. We have a young woman who was a student at KU who became a doctor, a medical doctor. And she became a gynecologist. And now she, her whole life is working with this, trying to help people. She's putting out tapes and CDs and helping people to understand that. The problem in 1968 when the Pope issued the encyclical was that at that time we didn't have any alternatives except what was called the rhythm method. And it was not always effective. Most of the time it was not effective. And most people identified we didn't have. And really what he was doing was challenging the medical and scientific community to come to a better response than a chemical response. And a couple response rather than just one person in the relationship. And so it's growing. And we have, even when I was in the parish of St. Anne's and we started it there, people were really, they really liked it. It gave a different perspective of marriage, a different perspective of the relationship. And so it was helpful to people.
How long a course would that be?
It would be 8 weeks.
8 weeks.
Where they would get to see the doctor. She gives the physiology of it, and then they give the theology of it, and then they give the practicality. So it takes that time. And then, if anyone is interested in pursuing that, then they have a practitioner. Like each person has a one-on-one with another person who guides them. So that they go through that for about 6 months to a year, and so they can see how things work.
So what other classes did you teach there?
What other classes did I
teach? Yeah, sure, you personally. Yeah. Or were taught there, either.
Yeah, well, I just taught what's called the Fundamentals of Catholicism. I was spending most of my time on the road trying to raise money and to get things going. And then the other people, that we would teach prayer. We would teach theology. We had theology of the body. I don't know if you've heard much about that. It's sort of a rage today. It's really a good understanding of person. We taught lessons on sacramental theology, on biblical, on scripture, on the foundation and the formation of scripture. And we've taught classes just on Catholicism in America, and just where we fit in with the other Christian groups. So those are mostly the classes. But we had a class on moral theology. So that was how do you form your conscience? How do you make judgments that would be judgments that would help you to grow and would not diminish you, but would help you.
Were these classes with reading assignments and tests?
No, we did. We weren't class in that sense. We didn't require the students to do any homework. Any homework or written papers. We did have a group of students that we called the Young Catholic Scholars, and they were a little bit more intense. We were able to provide them a scholarship, and then they had to write a paper each semester on some topic that they were working on at that time. And then we published a journal called the Young Catholic Scholars Journal. It was a very nice scholarship. It was like a $5,000 scholarship, so people would really want to work for that, but then they had to do other things if they received the scholarship. But in doing their work and doing their readings and everything, they just found it very fascinating.
Did you go on to divinity school? I mean, I'm not sure if that's how it's structured.
Well, you're right. Yeah, yeah. It's interesting that from 1983 until just this past spring, we've ordained priesthood 34. Jayhawkers, that's what I call them.
People who went through the center. Yeah, 34.
Have been ordained. Not only those are for many places, for St. Louis, for Wichita, Salina, all the places in Kansas, and then Omaha, Chicago. They were from different, because, you know, KU grad gathers from every place. And then we have seven women who are professed as women religious. They choose a lot of different orders, because a lot of different orders have a different specialization.
Have you kept up with anyone in particular
that makes? Yeah. I'm really proud of it. This guy that we have now, he was just ordained 2 years ago, and he's a chaplain of Hayden High School in Topeka. And he's really getting involved with those high school kids. It's great. He flies a plane. So when they had homecoming, he rented his plane, and he did a flyover, and he dropped down little footballs, you know, foam rubber footballs. And then he was in the band at KU, so he's in the band. And he's really, really involved himself in student life. But we have they're top-notch guys. All our KU guys that became ordained are, well, Father Mitchell, I don't know if you know him or not, but he's at St. Lawrence right now, and he does our recruiting for religious life, and he's really an excellent guy, so I have good things about all of them.
Well, despite that incredible record, there, here in the St. Lawrence Center, nationally, of course, numbers of priests continue to go down. Did that impact you and what you could do?
No, I mean, it only inspired me what we could do, you know, that is the national, but I think that there's sort of turned the corner of that. I think maybe it's just my opinion. That, but it looks like we are doing better than that. There's a whole, you know, there was a lot of time. I think when Vatican Council II happened, that a lot of people just thought that celibacy would be optional rather than required, and that was going to change. Then when that didn't change, then I think maybe people started to look at different ways. Because at that time, then we had a lot of priests who also thought it was going to change, and then he left and got married, and then it didn't change, and so that didn't work either.
But I guess, to me, it seems like for you to be the only priest there with all of these programs going on and things that stretch you awfully thin.
Yeah, I had always an assistant.
Did you always?
An assistant priest. Okay. Father Bill Porter was there for 8 years at Father Ray May, he was another pilot. He used to fly at night. And then I always had an assistant.
Oh, okay.
Well, that and that's help. Why I could even be away from the center a lot. So I could raise the money.
And I guess you must have had quite a staff beyond that.
I did, yeah. We had 21 people on our staff. That's all changed right now. It's not the same. But, and then when we really were short of parking. We had a parking lot that only held 90 cars, and we now are able to build a parking facility. It's just an underground and then a top ground. I love it because when it's real hot outside, you just park in the garage underneath. When it's raining or snowy or anything, you know, it's weatherproof almost.
Well, you've talked about the classes and things like that. What about social life? Did you have meals, cookouts, dances.
We had some of that. We didn't emphasize that a lot. We thought within the university there are many social things going on, and we encouraged people to do that. But we did have, well, we'd have Sunday night suppers where people would come together for that because they didn't serve Sunday night suppers in the residence halls. So we would have that, and then we would have always a big Thanksgiving dinner, which was a big deal, and a Christmas program. Mostly it was, and we had some sports activities too, but we really were focused on education. But, you know, that part is important for people if you want to have a whole program, because we're social beings and, you know, we like to recreate and have fun with each other too. We did have some dances early on when I was here in the Kansas Union. We'd always have a big Oktoberfest party. And we got this polka band out of Topeka. This guy would play the dulcimer. It was great. And students loved it. You know, we had a lot of fun.
Well, any of you have any other questions you'd like to ask?
What's the single accomplishment you hold in the highest regard that either you or the center was able to accomplish?
Well, I think probably it would have been the actual construction of the center, the chapel, and the center. And if you ever go there, you see that it was really built as an education center. It doesn't have a lounge or a TV or things like that. And we really, one of the things I really enjoyed was being able to work at the School of Architecture. And one of the classes used this as a design program. And actually, one of the professors from the School of Architecture consulted us in hiring the architecture to actually design the building we have now. That was big. Being able just to know that we got so many people interested in it, and that they all came together and everybody really, so it's really a whole lot of people. I guess maybe I would look at that for the material aspect. For the spiritual aspect, I would be really happy about all of the students who graduated from KU and then were active at St. Lawrence and who are now teaching at a Catholic school. We had a class at the School of Education called Teaching in a Catholic School, which the university let us have. It was, so we have teachers that we prepared. We have a lot of teachers who, like, we have students who don't go to the Catholic school, so they have a program, and we were able to certify teachers to be in that program. We have a lot of students who are active in parish work. So I'm really happy to see all over, like in Wichita, Kansas City, all of our bigger areas where our students are actively engaged in helping the church to grow. So that probably would be my greatest feeling.
Who was the professor you worked with in architecture? Was it Domer or Jerry?
No, Professor Michael.
Okay.
He was really, his last name was MICHEO, he was really wonderful. But he helped us, in fact, he developed a questionnaire for us that when we sent out letters to architects who may be interested. And most of the architects didn't understand the letter, you know, because he was talking about, how do you put spiritual realities into form? And how do you put ideas into form? And wanted to know what their process was themselves. And we, you know, our building, our chapel particularly, has received a lot of awards. And if you ever, House and Garden magazine, they did a big story on it. You know, and I can never figure out, how did you find out about us, you know, KU? and we didn't know how they were from New York, and they were very fascinated with the building. Remember that when they did that?
I don't remember that, but I'm not surprised. It's a beautiful place.
Yeah, it's not really nice. And it's more of a medieval building. It's a square building, which is it's simple. Lou Michael was his name, the professor. Michael was his last name. The day that he talked to us, you know, what his principle was that there's only one real architect, and that architect is God, and every other architect only imitates the true architect. And ever since then, I can't drive on the highway without thinking, wow, look at that. Look at the combination of colors. Look at the shape. Look at, you know, you look at everything and you go, wow, how did it all happen, you know? It's very interesting.
Let me ask something different. You just mentioned very briefly that you were chaplain of the KU football team. What was that like?
It was wonderful.
Was it really?
Yeah. You know, we did take two. I have two bowl rings, but they were the Aloha Bowl. You don't have the big bowls like the Orange Bowl or the Rose Bowl or anything like that. But I really loved it. What I found out that is that to be the chaplain of the team, and I had a co-chaplain with me, who's Reverend Barbie, and he and I were really good friends, and but it's a whole family. This is a football family. You have the players, and then you have the yell leaders, and you have the band, and you have the managers, and you have the medical staff, and you have the parents of the students, and it was really great. And we got to travel with the team. We got to stay with them whenever, wherever we went. And then we would always try to be a couple of days a week with the team at practice. And so I was under five different coaches, you know. The other day when they talked about now we're building again, I thought, oh, brother, here we go.
Here we go.
Always
again.
Rebuilding, you know, always rebuilding. But I enjoyed the whole opportunity. We got to know the players pretty well. They always, I don't know why, they always seemed to want us around, Reverend Barbie and myself. And one time we played Florida State down there, and we were coming home, and it was night. And when you're on a charter flight, everybody's out of their seats talking over the game or whatever. And pretty soon the captain came on, and he said, I'd like to have everybody take their seats. He said, we have just lost an engine, so we're going to teach you emergency landing. And we're going to have to land in St. Louis. So then everybody gets scared, you know. And it wants me to start praying, you know. Okay, let's go. I was as scared as they were. And then, so we practiced this emergency landing. And then when we get to St. Louis, you look down at the airport, there's all these red fire trucks and lights going on, all the fire trucks and ambulances. And, oh, my gosh. Maybe we're not even going to be able, maybe we're going to touch down. Something's going to happen, you know. So, but we finally landed safe and everything. But I tell you, a lot of those players are not getting back on another plane to fly back to Topeka. Because we always went in and out of Topeka because they had the Forbes Air Base there. But they said no. So then a couple of the coaching assistants had to stay back and charter a couple of buses and bring the guys back because they wouldn't get on a plane. That's enough. And for many of them, it was interesting. For many of the players, it's the first time they'd ever been on an airplane.
Is that right?
Yeah, you would think that. And I love that. I love being a chaplain with the team. I love to go to the games. And then after the games, there were always after game parties, and they were always fun. So, I really, that was part of being just part of the university family. And I just found it so rewarding.
How's it for you now? Like, what do you do with the days? You know, where do you go?
As retired?
Yeah.
I had to be kind of careful because I don't have any authority anymore. Uh-huh. So, I have been with the football team once this year. And now I just guy go to the Lead Center for programs that they had there. My nephew actually is the president of the Lead Center programs, or their board, what do they call it? Program, whatever it is. And I don't know if you know him, Dr. Matt Krishi, he's a dentist. And then I will go just to different functions that are here. And sometimes I'll be invited to a retirement party. All the people who were here when I was here were all retiring now, so they have retirement parties. And it's good to be with them. I get invited. Some of the people invite me out.
Do you have much to do with St. Lawrence Center?
I help out there a lot, but I just help out. I can't make any decisions. Although sometimes I slip into that mode, but then I better not do that.
I mean, you do things like say Mass.
I celebrate Mass twice on Sunday usually, and twice during the week, because we have Mass every day.
I presume that was a pretty big part of activity while you were there. I mean, daily Mass is something that is pretty widespread in the Catholic Church.
Yeah, we had that every day. And then we also had Mass at Danforth Chapel three times a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. So it was community for students. And we did weddings, you know.
Oh, sure.
And not very many funerals, but a few funerals, mostly from faculty people or faculty. It's always an important time.
Just to be clear, St. Lawrence Center is not a church, right?
Yeah, we're not a parish.
Not a parish, right? Yeah.
We were not designed as a parish. One of the problems that they have, that is, seems to me like it's even more of a problem now, is they have a lot of city or town folks come there, and they don't. They're really not university related, and I think that when that happens, you can lose your focus of what you're about.
Mm-hmm.
And I never wanted to lose the focus, and so I would always say, you know, you have to be university related, either student, faculty, staff, or administration people.
But you couldn't just shut other people out, could you?
Well. Sort of.
I knew someone who attended there pretty regularly who was not student or faculty.
We had some of that. But I really didn't want that to become. So that at the end of the problem is that, like, if people attend there, then if they get sick, go to the hospital, or they need pastoral care, then I couldn't focus on that. That takes a lot of time. And I didn't want to take my focus off of my responsibilities and what I was assigned for. But we did have some people who were very thinly related to the university. I know there was a couple, and she was some sort of an advisory board for one of the sorority houses. So that's a pretty thin connection.
That is. Well, do any of you have any other questions you'd like to ask Monsignor Vince? Open if you do. Otherwise, I don't want to keep you all night.
How long does your class go?
Well, we can go as long as 2.5 hours, but we usually go more like an hour, hour and a half.
Oh, yeah.
So we're at typical quitting time.
Yeah. So. Well, can I ask them a question?
Sure. Yeah, please do.
How'd you like tonight? Did you learn anything?
Actually, I thought it was really nice.
Thank you. Yeah, I hope I was able to contribute something to your understanding.
I'll say something pseudo-controversial. I've never considered the family planning ideal as for both people. That's interesting. Not just chemical, but a reason to do it is it falls on. But it does beg the question: if this, what about a male pill? But that's still chemical. You know?
Yeah, it's still chemical.
But it is something I learned.
Yeah, there's a whole development of that understanding, the psychology of love, and what does it mean for two people to give themselves entirely to each other out of love, and then what follows upon that in terms of your commitment. So it removes the sexual relationship out of just pleasure into a bigger reality. And you know, there was another thing that came from it was really surprising. So many of the married women who would come to help with this would have, they would trust their husbands, you know, because they would know that their husband really loved them because he was willing to engage in this. So that it was, it did, we had, you know, in terms of the divorce rate among people who practice this, we have 2%. So it's pretty low. But it is like a whole mutual cooperation, a mutual understanding. So it ties the relationship together. So what do you think about that?
That's what I think it's quite a note. It's something I look at the churches, since I've learned it, I can say not necessarily communicating that it's appealing when one thinks as a young woman, it's like, why is this on me? That I'm saying.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and
yeah.
The idea of it's more mutual.
Yeah.
It's an intriguing thing that I just made a note. It's like, what'd you learn in school today?
Yeah. You know, the interesting thing was that back in 1968, our understanding of fertility was less than 100 years old. It was never an issue, you know, because we needed people to populate the world, you know, and so it never became an issue until, you know, just this time, 100 years ago. And I will never forget. In 1968, when the Pope wrote the letter, man, he threw the church upside down, and he suffered a whole lot for it, just personally, just. But anyway, I was a very young priest. I was only 4 years old as a priest. And my friends and we all decided, God, what are we going to do? You got to talk about this on Sunday. What do you say? You know, like none of us agree with the Pope, but you can't get up openly and say that. Keep your job. So, so we got this bright idea. We said, oh, I know what this is. Let's put three theologians who support the Pope and three theologians who don't agree with the Pope, and then just walk off. So, oh yeah, so we're going to do it. We got it all worked out. We were young and naive and immature. And so I did that. And after Mass, there was this gentleman standing out there waiting for me. And this was 1968. And he was waiting, and he came up to me after everybody had gone. And he said, young man, if you believe that what you just did was the right thing, then I think you must leave the priesthood. And I'll tell you what, I have an insurance brokerage, and I will hire you at $25,000 a year to begin with. He and his wife had 9 children, and he was a good Catholic, and he thought that what I did was a big offense. And it was the best thing. He and I are really, really good friends. You know, it was the best thing. But I didn't know what else to do because we had no alternative. So we just ignored the question until it was about 1972. There was a program at St. Mary's Hospital in Kansas City, which is no longer there. But it has nothing to do with the program. It's not there anymore. But I went to that, and there was a couple in Minnesota, and they came and were talking about this, and there was a nun who was a medical missionary who worked in Africa, and she was also a gynecologist, and she was giving the presentation on it. And I went to that, and I, wow, it was really interesting. But it was new, you know, we didn't have it all worked, you know, we've learned more and more. The big center for this right now is up in Omaha. But at the end of the conference, this gentleman stood up, and he was a dairy farmer. And he had his bib overalls on, you know, his hands and his butt like that. And he said, you know, I learned something tonight. And she said, well, what's that? He said, you know, I learned that my wife is fertile about 4% of the time, and I'm fertile 100% of the time. Now I want to know, whose problem is it? And honestly, that opened the door for me. It opened, I said, wow, this is great. You know, that's an interesting question. Because everybody put it on the woman before, you know. And so, it's growing, their understanding of it. But it's big. It's a big item. And like the Pope thought that the chemical response was just inadequate for the dignity of the human being, you know, the person. And everything that he predicted in 1968 has come true. More infidelity in marriage, more divorces in marriage, more children out of marriage. And then the whole population thing, what we're doing in Western Europe is, it seems the minority, or what, it's a minority, but there are other people, third world nations. Oh, this is an interesting thing. Can I say this?
Yeah.
Because I was in Boston at the time, and there was a priest there, and I was talking to him, and he said, you know, I said, well, how did, because the Pope had gone to India just a couple months before that. I said, he saw what was happening with people, and how does he do this? And this priest told me, he was from Catholic Charities, and he said, you know, it was the request of the people from the third world who were saying to the Pope that to not approve, and the Pope doesn't make decisions on that basis, but they were afraid that the first world nations, which was Western Europe and the United States, would use birth control, chemical birth control, as a form of genocide. And then we would lessen their population. And then that's the way. And that was a very interesting thing of it. And then you know what exactly has happened? Is that we lessened ourselves. And they didn't believe it, you know. In India and in the third world nations, in Latin America, they didn't believe it and they never practiced it. So then we're now where we're in a different position, even in the United States, I think. And Western Europe is in worse trouble. And the interesting thing about that is we're all Catholic countries. I mean, Western Europe, France, Italy, Germany. So, had you heard that?
No, I don't think I had.
It's an interesting perspective to it. The doctor, Dr. Djerassi, I think I said that right, Djerassi, he was one of the three who developed that. And it was like a year ago he came out saying it's the worst thing he ever did. He's caused Austria, at least, to commit what he calls national suicide.
And Scandinavia, I believe, is a negative population.
Yeah.
So I can see in the near future where we're going to be encouraging people to have as many children as they can because we've got to build the population base.
I think France already pays a family, or maybe it's Canada, I'm thinking of. There are countries that pay a bonus if you have children.
Yeah, through the income tax. I hope we get this all worked out.
Yeah. Well, if you can solve all the world's problems for us, would you please let us know?
Then we can do that, yeah. Any other questions you guys might
have? Yes.
Did you find it interesting?
I did.
Good. I bet.
Not hard to see you have good relationships with students. A lot of practice.
Oh, yeah. I love working with students. When I got to that parish, it was so different.
I did want to ask about that, actually, but since it didn't seem like you... How long were you there? And
4 years. And they were really nice people. And the advantage that I had there is that I never worked with older people. And I worked with a lot of older people. I did... 1 week, I had 5 funerals every day. But it's very interesting. It brought me into a whole new area of life that I hadn't really related with very much. And I had done some here, but not. And then visiting people who were just in the home, you know, couldn't go any place. I really loved that. And also, we had a great school. And our school is a really good school. Academics were great. And we had excellence from Kansas Board of Education, stuff like that. But I'd never worked with little kids before. And this is very interesting, too, you know. I can tell you some funny stories about those little kids, you know. But, you know, you walk out of your office and go by the playground, and all of them jump, hi, Monsignor, hi. They're jumping up and down, you know. And they would just come over and play ball with him or something like that. And, but for the... You know, to try to really get people fired up. That was hard to do. I was not able to do that. And it's probably my fault, not their fault, but I didn't know how to go about it the right way, I guess. Because it was not hard to fire students up. I mean, they, what do you want to do? Yeah, let's do it. Let's go. It's a good idea, you know. So, it was wonderful. You never had to worry about that.
Students are here every day, and a lot of the people in Prairie Village is a one day a week.
That's right. Mm-hmm. You're right. Yeah. I know. Yeah, that is true. Yeah. And then the people in an education environment were in an education environment, so it was easier to get them interested. Okay.
Well, thank you for coming in. I hope your retirement in Lawrence is wonderful in every way.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I really enjoyed it. And thank you for your attention. And you know, if you ever would come back, call like an hour before.
Okay.
It's the second time. Could you? I was so embarrassed. Oh, no. What did I do? I had some problems with my house, and a plumber had come by, and that got me distracted. So you probably said, oh, I know why you're retired. You can't remember. You don't know where you're supposed to be.
I can't remember anything.